From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, call us now at 800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our callers, some interesting topics to talk about.
Right. Another reason to eat more fruits and veggies. We'll talk about fruits and veggies and their relationship to cataract prevention.
Ooh,
and sitting is the new smoking. New data that shows that is right on.
Spot on. And what's our recipe?
Santa Fe skillet chicken. You will like it. It is a great dish. If you want to make chicken tonight, this is your recipe.
I think I'll love it because Santa Fe, to me, implies nice and spicy.
Yes, absolutely. And it is.
800-462-7413 is our number. And Zorba, our first caller, is a listener in Edison, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
You spoke, Zorba, on one of your past shows about the effect of stress on an unborn child, and I wanted you to go into that a little more. My situation was my godmother would always say to me, you know, I kept your brother when your mom had you in the hospital, and she had to stay over an additional month. The hospital held her for another month because of the things that were going on at home.
Oh, you mean held your mom for enough? Your mother stayed in the hospital for a month.
Correct.
Oh, that is a lot. What sort of things were going on, if you want to share with us?
An abusive relationship.
An abusive relationship. Okay. So,
yeah, with my father.
Well,
that
certainly defines stress. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. Finish the rest of your story. Sorry to interrupt.
And consequently, I stayed with her. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wasn't separated from my mother. I stayed with her in the hospital and then came home. So I guess, you know, and you touched on that in previous shows and
right.
had said that it could have, you know, some type of emotional or psychological effect on the child, you know, as they develop. So I was wondering what your take on that was and whether it's something, you know, typically if a mother is taking some type of substance abuse, the child will have, you know, some type of effect or ramifications from it.
Right.
So I was wondering if there were any studies showing that this is true for stress.
Well, the studies that I've talked about and actually looked at have looked at depression in the mother. So depression specifically, treated or not treated, what happens to the child later on when the mother is depressed, when she's depressed often during the pregnancy, not necessarily even after the pregnancy. We're not talking about postpartum depression, but we're talking about depression within the pregnancy, the issues that can affect the pregnancy outcome being sooner, born in a more premature way, lack sometimes of a baby developing within the womb, not having a good birth weight baby, but a low birth weight baby. But then it also looked at the risk of depression for the child later on, so when the child grows up. And the answer is, no doubt, there is a risk. And it seems to be, you know, we have known for years, of course, that depression is either inherited, there may be a genetic trait to it, or it may be learned early on, or it may be both, which is what I ascribe to. I think it probably is a combination of things. But when we look at it from a point of view of what's going on in utero, when the baby is actually in the mom developing, we're finding out that a lot of things happen that we have never looked at and therefore have never measured that. So if you're mom's under stress, when you're inside the body, it may be that you're going to be more stressed later on in life. And we can't separate that out, though, from activity that happens after, you know, after the baby is born. That's kind of what it is. So the answer is yes. I think stress is learned and inherited, and it can occur during the pregnancy. We've also found that women who are pregnant under egregious circumstances, such as war, then it has an effect on the child later on, not only in what they have, but they also can develop other things such as diabetes and hypertension when they're adults.
Yeah.
And so we're just beginning to understand how important that in utero activity is for that. How did things ultimately turn out in your family?
how did they ultimately turn out? Well, they separated eventually. You know, that was a generation that stayed together because of the kids.
Correct.
So, you know, it wasn't until I left the house, went to college, got married, that she decided to, well, she didn't even decide to leave. She basically left and, you know, everything kind of dissolved. And she, you know, moved on with her life. My mom passed away at 75 and, you know, had a much better life, quote unquote, you know, later on emotionally, psychologically, without him because she didn't have that stress.
So she, when she finally divorced, when she finally left, she had a richer life, a better life on her own.
I felt so. I felt so. You know, she didn't really want to be involved again with, you know, in any type of relationship. She was done with that.
That
was enough for her.
One and done. But you bring up an interesting interesting thing. We had a good friend of ours, and she divorced her husband when she was 88. At 88. And the family said, well, why don't you just stay with him? You know, you've been with him this long. And she was in an abusive, not a physically abusive, but an emotionally abusive relationship. And she said, 'cause I don't want to. Well, why are you doing it now? Because I finally woke up and smelled the coffee, and I don't want to be with him anymore. And so she left him, and the relatives had to deal with him. You know, he couldn't boil water, and he was an obstinate sort of gruff guy. And so the relatives, the sisters and the brothers, basically, they didn't want to deal with him. They wanted, they knew what it was like. They wanted her to deal with him. You know, she left after, you know, 50 years of marriage, and she had four to, it was either 4 years or 6 years of a really good life.
Definitely.
Moved into a community where life was really better. And people would say, why did you wait so long? And she said, well, I just waited too long, didn't I? And then she went on with her life.
Thank you.
You know, she went on with her life. So,
excellent point.
Well, thank you for sharing it with us. And
thank you.
And it's very interesting how important that prenatal environment is. It's critical for a healthy child and a healthy adult.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for the call at 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Lake Villa, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
I have a friend that is addicted to opiates, and he wants to get off of them, and he reads about this fast detox. It's not in Illinois, though, and I want to know if it is it real.
Oh yes. No. It's definitely real, and it works for some. It works for some people, and this is a detox situation. It's very expensive. I think they run $5,000. Is that what they run? Somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000.
Oh.
I mean, it's somewhere in that range. It might be more. But basically, because insurance does not pay for it, you're put, the good ones, you're put in a hospital-type setting. It's not a hospital, but it's a detox hospital. It's a facility. They rapidly take you off. You go through withdrawal. So they take you off your opioids. They go through a withdrawal that is rapid. In other words, it's not all at one time, but it's pretty quick. They follow you. They treat you for the side effects of the opioids, and I have two or three patients over the period of lifetime who have actually done this, who have been chronically on opioids, who have tried to go off and they have failed, and they've gone to rapid detox, and that has worked for them. And as far as I know, two of them have moved away, moved to a different state, moved to Tennessee. I don't know how they're doing. But they were off opioids 2 to 3 years later. They were still off their opioids. I mean, so really, it really does work. You know, if they try, a regular detoxification can work, especially with the use of Suboxone. Suboxone is a drug that's used, can be used for detox. You need a special license to be able to use it.
Are there a lot of these facilities?
Well, I don't know if a lot is the word. They're around. They're the ones these people went to were in the state of Florida. Florida has a lot, but Florida has a lot of drug abuse. Florida, by the way, probably is number one for pill-pushing doctors, where you come in and spend 5 minutes for a doctor, get your prescription, come back in a month, spend 5 minutes with your doctor, get the prescription. There are a lot of those that really have been shut down thanks to some changes in the law, and thanks to a much more active and aggressive medical licensing board. But there are a lot of, you know, there are more addicts in Florida per capita than a lot of other states in the union. What's your friend on? Do you know?
Oxycodone. Mm-hmm. And he's got it from the doctor to start with, and now he's not. Now mm-hmm. he's getting it on the street.
Oh, now he's getting it on the street.
I'm not quite sure exactly what it is.
Uh-huh. Has he tried to detox?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
right now he's in the process again.
Uh-huh.
And he's working with a psychiatrist.
Good, good.
Mm-hmm. But he just wishes it could be faster.
Mm-hmm.
And he is on, I think that is the medicine he's taking right now, Suboxone. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Suboxone is a very good medication. You know, a good psychiatrist, good psychologist, good therapist can often do this. It's not done as quickly as it's done in those more controlled environments that are hospital-like environments. So he's got to think about it. But they're expensive, not covered by insurance. You know,
right.
You know, that's the other side. But good for him, headed in the right direction. The real issue is when you get off, you can't ever have that again. Mm. Anything at all. Hydrocodone, oxycodone, codeine. Even dextromethorphan in a cough syrup, I wouldn't take any of that. You've got to read labels, and you've got to make sure you never touch it again. I mean, that's, you know, it's like Alcoholics Anonymous. One and
right.
done, and then you're finished.
Mm-hmm. So, okay.
So.
Well, I know he also likes that, which it's not NyQuil, but it's like NyQuil. It's for sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Well, NyQuil contains Benadryl. That's all it takes. And that's okay. Benadryl will not hurt him.
Okay.
You know, NyQuil or DayQuil. Now, if he takes decongestants, which have Sudafed in them, Sudafed is what's used for meth.
Okay.
Decongestants can put people up and make them feel like they want something else. He should be careful with decongestants. You know, once you're addicted to something like that and you've tried to detox and fail, you have to be very careful with any other drug that can inebriate you, from alcohol all the way to decongestants. So. Good luck to your friend. They are real. I don't know exactly how you would evaluate which site is real, but they definitely are real, and there are a number of sites that work.
Okay.
Good luck.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks,
Jacob. Appreciate the call. Thank you very much. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, before we get back to the phones, we know fruits and vegetables are good for us, but they can help fight cataracts?
Yeah, they help fight cataracts. By the way, what percentage of Americans eat 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day? Now, when I'm talking about a serving, I am not talking about the rabbit diet. I'm talking about a kind of nice bowl of salad, piece of fruit. And when we talk about a potato, let's talk about a potato that is not fried in oil laced with lard, as some places.
Well, the answer is almost none.
The answer is very few. The answer is like 20-30%. It's an astoundingly small number.
Yeah.
Well, if you had the French fry, you get a little bit higher, but they're not really good. But that's what it is. You need more fruits and vegetables. But these were 1,000 pairs of female twins, okay? These are female twins. Filled out detailed food questionnaires, tracked their intake. The mean age was 50 when they started. They looked at them, followed them, 324 pairs of twins. They followed them over a period of time, and they looked at women who consumed at least 2 servings of fruit and 2 servings of vegetables a day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 2 servings of fruit, 2 servings of vegetables a day. And they had a 20% lower risk of developing cataracts than 20 to 30%, depending on which way you measure it, of the women who did not eat 2 servings of fruit and 2 servings of vegetables a day. And they had identical twins. So basically, some twins were better than others.
Yeah,
you know, these are identical twins. So some twins are going to do a good job, and other twins are not going to do a good job of eating. And the twins who ate more fruits and vegetables, that twin did better.
Yeah. Well, that's not
cataracts.
A big surprise. I mean,
you're
healthy.
Well, I don't know. I never thought the cataracts were related to food.
Yeah,
and it appears to be the vitamin C that's winning.
Including cataracts, I would think.
But why would you do cataracts and heart disease? We know it reduces heart disease, certain forms of cancer. Where does cataracts come in? But I think you have a good point. We know that a more Mediterranean diet is a better diet. It turns out it also affects our eyes.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll find out that other things that affect our eyes that can cause blindness, you know, such as macular degeneration, might also be related to fruits and vegetables.
Interesting.
Yeah.
800-462-7413. And a Lake Geneva caller's with us now, Zorba. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. How can we help?
So I was hoping you could help me do some myth busting or confirming, I guess. my mom and my dad and my grandma's, like, everyone has always told me if you go outside, particularly when it's cold, when your hair is wet, that you will get sick. Or, like, if you go to bed with a wet head, then you'll get sick. And I just don't know if that is true. So I was hoping you could help me out.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
They always told me I'd get a cold.
You'd always get a cold, yeah. Death of cold. That's the death of cold. That's right. And it turns out that is absolutely a myth. It is not true. It is not true. Your head is wet, you will not get sick. You will not get a cold. You will not get pneumonia. Now, you may get the bed wet, which is really dumb and stupid, and you should make sure you wipe your hair. But it is totally a myth. Like, no, don't go to bed with that. Your hair is not dry. You're going to get sick, death of pneumonia. Absolutely a myth, which has been handed down for centuries by grandmothers to the next mother, to the next mother, to the next grandmother. So you can be assured it isn't it. But, and they've done studies on this. They have put college students to bed with wet heads, with wind, with cold air coming through there. You'll catch death of cold. Close the window.
That's
don't
right.
open up the windows in the car. It's a myth.
Years ago, Zorba, I don't know if you remember this, they sat a bunch of guys on ice cubes.
Yes. Yes, yes. Were you one of those?
No, but then nobody got sick.
No, nobody got sick. That's exactly it. So who's telling you this, your mother or your grandmother or both?
All of the above.
All of the above.
Yeah, it's great to hear because I used to have my dad would have me blow dry my hair before I went to bed. and it's so relieving that that's not true because I have curly hair. And I don't know if you know what happens when you blow dry curly hair, but it turns into a giant afro. So this is great that it's a myth.
The curly hair turns into a giant afro. That is really funny. No, you do not have to blow dry your hair before you go to sleep. You can just dry your hair with a towel so the pillow doesn't get super wet, and go to sleep, and believe me, you will not catch your death of a cold.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank
Take
you so note. Much for calling. I've got to get the image of a bunch of naked guys sitting on ice cubes out of my head.
They may not have been naked. They may have been in swimsuits.
Before we take a break, Zorba, how about we let one of our listeners give us a piece of his mind in a segment we call Disagreeing with the Doc. The following email came to us from a listener named Tom in South Wayne, Wisconsin.
Tom, what a great name.
I love it, Tom. I mean,
number one name. This will be a number one story.
Dear Zorba, he says, I noticed that on a recent show, you again mentioned that organic produce has no pesticides used in their production. In fact, there are several 1,000 pesticide products approved for use by organic producers. Some approved products can be toxic, too. This is something to look into and include in future discussions. Thanks to you and Tom for a great show.
Organic pesticides, yes, absolutely correct. They're organic pesticides. But I wonder who actually specifies what an organic pesticide is.
Which is okay and which isn't.
Right. So I know, for instance, let's say you're going to use soap. I mean, soap is used as a pesticide to keep insects away on some fruits. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be an organic pesticide, something that would be approved. It's going to be very different than 2,4-D or, of course, things that, you know, such as been outlawed, such as DDT. So very good. You know what? You know what? Thanks for that information. That's very good. I'm learning something. I'm educable.
Do you disagree with something Zorba said? Let us know by posting it on our Facebook page or sending us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up, Zorba. Lots more of our calls, too. Some interesting emails to read. And our medical mythbuster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up, but first, Zorba, Santa Fe skillet chicken.
Yes, now, you like chicken, don't you?
I like chicken.
You like chicken, and you like spicy food.
I do like spicy food. Yes.
In fact, as soon as we say it, you just sort of have this smile
indeed
on your face. So this is a really good recipe with really good spice, something you will like, and it's easy. It's easy. You like
that's all good.
When you're cooking, you like easy.
I'm going to cook this the next time I cook.
So I won't hold my breath.
Okay.
Won't hold my breath.
Yeah.
Monica cooks a lot. Doesn't she cook a lot?
No.
No, she doesn't. Oh, so neither. How about Cooper?
Don't tell me. Don't tell anybody I said that. Okay.
Cooper. Wait a minute. We're on radio.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. Okay. Let's do it.
So 1 pound of boneless, skinless chicken breast.
1 pound boneless, skinless chicken breast.
And you know where to buy that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's I do, actually.
2 tablespoonfuls of taco seasoning.
2 big T taco seasoning.
Now, this is where this is actually the most important part of the recipe.
Okay.
You can buy a whole variety of taco seasonings. They're a bunch, they're blended seasonings. Penzi's Spices, and we'll put a link on my website, Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Penzi's. Favorite spice shop, Wisconsin Spices. They're great. They're fresh. Mm. They're good. Their taco seasoning is my favorite. And they don't have one kind. They have several kinds. Yeah. They have some that are hotter.
P-E-N-Z-Y.
I do not own stock in the company because it's a family-owned company. Yeah. But they have really, really good really good spices. And if not, I recommend if you're going to buy a taco seasoning, try a few kinds. You may like one versus another.
Yeah.
2 tablespoonfuls taco seasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Teaspoon of cayenne pepper.
Little tea cayenne pepper.
You're going to use some kosher salt.
Okay.
2 cloves of garlic minced.
2 cloves of garlic minced.
1 small red onion chopped, coarsely chopped.
A small red onion chopped.
2 red bell peppers chopped.
2 red bell peppers chopped.
A 15-ounce can of black beans drained and rinsed. Very important to rinse it and drain it.
Mm-hmm. A 15-ounce can of black beans drained and rinsed.
1 cup of shredded cheddar cheese or pepper jack, or you might try Munster, or you might even use Gruyere. I don't care what kind of cheese you use. You need 1 cup.
Cup of cheese.
Mm-hmm. Do you like cheddar?
Yes, very
Swiss?
Much.
Do you like Swiss?
Yeah.
Gruyere?
Oh, I like all cheese.
All cheese. So, I mean, different cheeses will give different flavors. Pepper jack. Okay, and then if you like cilantro, cilantro. If you don't like cilantro, use parsley.
Fresh cilantro.
You know, my mother always said the world is divided into 2 people, those who like cilantro and those who don't.
My mother never heard of cilantro.
Right. My mother also never heard of cilantro. I don't think my mother heard of parsley. My mother never heard of squash. We never had squash in our house. She never heard of squash. She heard of sweet potatoes. They existed on Thanksgiving, and that was it. Otherwise, canned peas, corn, beans, lima beans, yuck. I still cannot stand lima beans. What else? What other vegetables?
Green beans.
Green beans, yeah. What else? Anything else?
I think that's it.
Lettuce. Iceberg lettuce. We didn't have romaine, right? Iceberg lettuce. Tomato, cucumber.
Oh, no, not tomato.
Yeah, no, we had tomato. Did you have green onions? Never. We never had green onions.
No.
Think about it. I don't know.
Let's put this recipe.
I'm sorry. I hate to limit. Okay. Season the boneless, skinless chicken breast with the taco seasoning, cayenne pepper, and salt. Then in a large Teflon skillet over medium-high heat, put a tablespoonful or two of oil. Now, if you don't want to use a Teflon skillet, you could use what we have in our house, which basically is a cast iron skillet that has been cured. And that works really, really well. Mm-hmm. So that's fine, too. Add the chicken. Cook it until it's no longer pink, about 6 minutes on each side. Transfer the chicken now to a plate. Then, in the skillet, if you're going to use in the skillet, you take all the stuff that's on the surface of the skillet, all the little bits of spices and chicken, add garlic, onion, red bell pepper to the skillet. Cook it until it's tender, about 5 minutes. Then, after it's tender, stir in the black beans until they're just warm. Transfer it to a bowl. Then reduce the heat and return the chicken to the skillet. Top it with the cheese and the black bean mixture. cover it and wait until that cheese melts. Garnish it with cilantro and parsley and serve it. And you've got a wonderful,
sounds wonderful, delicious dish.
Yeah, it really is good.
How can I get this recipe?
Well, you have to ask. You know, you have to ask how to do it, which you've done. You've done what we call the ask, you know, in the business of that. And you know what that ends? You get a website. So you've got to go fire up the computer, that old DOS computer, load some DOS in there, and go to ZorbaPastor.org.
K-Pro.
At ZorbaPastor.org. Don't forget, folks, we're on Facebook. We love it. And keep on commenting on all those pictures I put up on Facebook. They're wonderful. The pictures get more hits than anything else we put up on Facebook.
Or if I wanted the recipe, you could just hand it to me.
Here. There you are. Take
you
the recipe.
You crumpled it up.
That's it. Well, I wanted to make the noise to show that I was actually handing the recipe.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. A Maryville, Tennessee listener is with us now, Zorba. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I am a consumer of dairy products and soy products, and I have had no problems, but I have been reading and hearing that some people are experiencing trouble, and I've read some alarming articles about how both of those products, in one way or the other, increase levels of female hormones in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you had had any experience with problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, there's a lot of alarmist stuff, a lot of alarmist things on the web. We know that. We all know that. You know, you can do soy milk bad, and then you'll get a whole bunch of websites. You know, the National Association Against Soy and Soy Products. And then when it comes to milk products, you get lots even more. You get all the soy people who are against it, and then you've got people who are just against it because we're milking cows and destroying animals, and of course, you know, milk comes from cows, and we do milk cows. When we look at actual changes in hormone levels in people, they are not measurable. But the question about soy are something called phytoestrogens. And phytoestrogens are estrogen-like compounds that you consume with soy products. And this has kind of been around for a long time, whether or not these are actually harmful or not harmful. And there's been research on it. There's been research looking at cardiovascular disease, looking at breast cancer, looking at ovarian cancer, which are really mitigated and essentially amplified by estrogen. And the question is, should women drink soy milk because that will increase their risk of breast cancer? That's really the bottom line for most of these studies. And right now, heretofore, we have not seen any evidence at all that is credible, published in reputable, peer-reviewed scientific journals that either show soy is bad for us or milk is bad for us. Now, we know milk, you know, is a problem because it's got some saturated fats. Too much milk is not good for us. But there's no evidence that it really causes cancer and heart disease.
We
except
used to worry about BGH in milk.
Yeah, and BGH. We worried about BGH. You brought up a good point. We can't measure it. We don't see it. But that was a very good point about BGH. But you can't separate that milk. You can't measure it in the milk. But that has been a question. So what are you concerned about? What are you most worried about?
Well, I was my cousin has gone the vegan route.
Okay.
And so I'm getting all these articles.
Vegans. Mm-hmm. Vegans. Vegans. No, I'm not against vegans. But vegans are against soy milk. Well, is she against soy milk as a vegan?
No. He's against regular milk.
Oh, regular.
Cow's milk.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me a scathing article about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, it sounds almost like they're cherry picking certain studies to prove their point.
You've got it. That's
excited at the beginning.
That is exactly what it is. Now, there have been arguments about milk and dairy. And when we talk about milk, let's talk about cheese, yogurt, milk. Let's talk about them all together because they all come from cows. You can have a you can be against it because you're just against anything for animals. And I think that is respectable. That's just a way of viewing things. Nothing wrong with that at all. You don't want to have any animal food because you want to make sure you only have plant-based products. And there are a number of people who do it, and I applaud them for doing it because they want to do it. And I think a plant-based food version is good. But there's very good evidence that the protein we get from animal products are one of the things that really fuels our brain and makes us healthy. Too many animal products to consume are also not good. But soy has its issue with estrogen, so there have been some issues with soy. So every time he sends you something on milk, you should send him a website about soy and the problems with eating soy. And then you'll set up a dialogue with your cousin.
Okay.
So are you a vegan?
No, I eat everything.
You eat everything. You're an omnivore. You're an omnivore.
That's right.
So, well, good luck. I hope that will add fodder to the argument.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that call at 800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Before the break, Zorba, let's hear from your favorite backseat drivers, the Grammar Police.
You know, every time I hear that jingle, I really smile.
That's good. Actually, Zorba, we're going to hear from the Soap Police.
Oh, okay.
The following letter comes to us from a New York listener named Patrick. He writes, "Dear Dr. Pastor, on a recent show, I heard your recommendation for someone with dry skin, not bathe. Yuck! That's a bitter trade-off. Having dry skin or having friends, coworkers, family, etc. Yikes. With your emphasis on natural products and wholesomeness, I'm surprised you haven't come across this. Slather yourself with a compound made of pig fat and lye. It's called soap. It's not the type of soap you
Colonial
buy stores.
Colonial soap. Pig fat. Lard.
It's the kind you make in your own kitchen.
I
mailed you some that I made myself. It's basically old-fashioned lard soap. A lard mixed with lye and water, and it works for my dry skin. If you try it, two things will happen. You'll get a very, very different feeling on your skin after a shower. Second, you'll never go back to regular soap. Good luck with it."
What I really want to know is, will I start to say oink, oink?
Have you received? He says he
nailed
you.
I have. It's right over here. I'm going to hold it up to the microphone so everyone can see it.
Okay. Look at that,
okay.
Folks.
Can you guys see it? Yeah. It's very nice. It's got some blue speckles in it. It looks kind of nice. And
it's kind
has
of a
no
bluish
smell
color.
To it. No smell to it. And you know what it feels like?
What?
Soap.
Yeah.
it feels like soap. And you know what? I think what I'm going to do with this is I'm not going to take a video of myself soaping up in the shower.
We all want to see that.
That would not be a public radio video. But I will take a video soaping up and at the Wisconsin Public Radio washroom. That's mm-hmm. what I will do.
Yeah.
And we'll paste this on Facebook, and then we'll see. I'll see what I like about it. And like I said, it does have a smell to it. You smell it. Here, smell it for a second. Can you smell? It has a little smell to it.
Oh, it smells nice.
Yeah, it smells very nice. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't have a fragrance that's been added to it, but, you know, it smells like soap. It's a nice, nice texture
And you're
it.
Going to try it.
I'm going to try it. That's right. I'm going to try it. That's
okay.
Right.
Have you worked yourself up in a lather about something Zorba said? Join the ever-growing Grammar Police Force and send your grievance along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have more of your calls coming up. We have later on our medical myth buster and some interesting research to talk about. That's coming up next here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up at 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, sitting increases the risk of dying early?
Dying early. You know, sitting is the new smoking. I mean, and I like that. I did not make up that phrase. My wife Penny's trainer, Laura, said that initially, and I thought, hey, that's a good jingle. Sitting is the new, you know, sitting is the new smoking.
Yeah.
And there's some interesting studies before we get into this. A book called The Blue Zones, looking at people who live long lives in Europe and Central Europe and other places, you know, often in communities that are rural communities. They're not super urban communities. Mm-hmm. And what he discovered, the particular researcher, is that people don't sit for long periods of time. They don't go to the gym. They don't run. They don't jog. They just don't sit. In other words, every 15 or 20 minutes, they seem to be getting up and doing things around. They're not sitting in front of the computer, as many of us do. Yeah. All day. And
they walk to the store maybe or walk the dog.
They walk to the store. They often walk to get fruits and vegetables. You know, the city that people walk in the most in this country happens to be the most urban city, which is New York City.
New York, yeah.
Yeah, because...
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, now, and they happen to turn out, senior citizens happen to be very healthy in New York. This particular research looked at 54 countries analyzing the time spent sitting for more than 3 hours a day. And it was studied in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, very good journal, and more than 60% of the people worldwide who spent more than 3 hours a day sitting down were at a higher risk for sudden death, premature death before the age of 75, which is how it is. And the estimated mean sitting time across countries was almost 5 hours a day. So people, when they're active, are often sitting 5 hours a day. And I certainly understand that. I mean, I have a medical practice. I have a, you know, I've got a Misfit now. Instead of my Fitbit, instead of my Nike, instead of my Jawbone, I've got a Misfit. And the Misfit tells me that on a busy day in the office, I'm only getting 2,500 steps, which means when I'm in the office for 8-10 hours, I'm sitting.
That's one of those things that goes on your wrist.
Goes on my wrist, fancy pedometer. You can now get these things for $20-$30 at discount stores. But if you have one, you'll discover you spend most of your time sitting. And you just mentioned you spend a lot of time sitting.
I do. Now especially. I'm in recovery. You know.
Recovery. How about when you're not in recovery? Do you spend as much time or do
not
you
not as much time sitting?
Yeah. So I think this points out something that's very important. We want to be fit, we want to be healthy. And we look at the fact that we have to get up, jog in the morning, exercise, hit the gym or whatever, but we don't think about sitting as another factor. So if you want to live a longer, sweeter life, you also have to look at how much time you spend sitting and get up and move throughout the day, and you'll live longer.
800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Dr. Pastor. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
I have a question about, I have a 15-year-old daughter who has pretty often recurring mouth sores, like mouth ulcers, and she's had them since, you know, back to when she was 8 or 9. And I didn't know, she's a vegan. I don't know if that makes a difference, but she wasn't when she was, you know, 8, 9 or so. But just recurring mouth sores, we tried, the dentist has recommended a different toothpaste, so we're using one of the ones that's for sensitive teeth that's missing a certain chemical. Mm-hmm. But that hadn't seemed to help. And mm-hmm. I was curious about the causes and then also things like gargling salt water, gargling peroxide, that sort of thing.
Sure. So the toothpaste you switched to is a non-fluoridated toothpaste. I assume that there's no fluoride in the toothpaste because that can produce it too. And sodium lauryl sulfate, I think that's what it is. That's the name of the chemical that's often in there that can cause problems. But if your dentist recommended something like Sensodyne, that is one of the toothpastes that I think can be very good. How often do our mouth sores occur?
I mean, it's more often that she has one than not. Mm-hmm. So very regularly.
So all the time. She's a vegan, like you said. Does she get soy yogurt?
No.
I would recommend it. And the reason is soy yogurt has probiotics. And regular yogurt that comes from a cow has natural probiotics, lactobacillus and other bacteria that basically ferment the yogurt. And they're good bacteria. Soy yogurt, when they make it, does not naturally have probiotics, but they put them in there. And what you want to do is choose a brand that says filled with probiotics has probiotics, but most soy yogurt has probiotics within it. It may actually be all of them, but I know some of them do, and in the not-too-distant past, not all of them did at all. That would be the first thing I would do, because often that's a problem, that you've got to repopulate your mouth with good bacteria that then basically keep the viruses, because cold sores are caused, they're called aphthous ulcers, and they're caused by viruses that are often in the mouth, and using probiotics may be all that she needs to do. How's her oral hygiene? Brushes twice a day?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Very, very good with that.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much does she get enough vitamin C in her diet, do you think?
I'm not sure. She takes a multivitamin, and she's been to a nutritionist that has given her some vitamins mm-hmm. and a few supplements. Mm-hmm.
The other thing is you may want to look into vitamin C. And 500 milligrams four times a day, if the yogurt probiotics do not work, you know, then I would look at vitamin C, 500 milligrams four times a day, and I'd stay in it for a month or two. And I would get, there's vitamin C that you get that is chewable, and that's the vitamin C I would recommend, because you then chew it, and then there's vitamin C touching the mucous membranes in the mouth, and that can be very useful. And aphthous ulcers, these ulcers in the mouth sometimes can be very, very pesky, very pesky.
Yeah, they've been persistent. And then things like gargling salt water or gargling peroxide.
You know, I've not been impressed with that. You know, you could try it. I've not been impressed that really works. You know, people have recommended it, but I haven't seen that it works. Certainly has not worked in my practice. C and probiotics, that seems to be that's the recipe that hits the spot.
Okay, well, great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. You're welcome. Good luck.
Thanks for calling at 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, time again now for our medical myth-buster segment. Today's question is from a listener, Harry, in El Paso, Texas. He writes, "Hi, Zorba and Tom. My mother never told me to not pinch my nose when sneezing, or you'll blow your brains out. But she herself would kind of swallow or somehow stifle her sneezes to make them quieter. Then one day, she found herself stooped over the kitchen garbage can with blood spurting from her nose, calling 911. Turns out, an artery had burst, and she had to have it cauterized. I don't know if the stifling had anything to do with it, but if I can't get to a Kleenex, I turn my head into my elbow and let it rip. Is there anything to this, or is it just a myth?"
Well, first of all, if you pinch your nose, you don't blow your brains out. I mean, how many people have you ever seen with, you know, brains blown out?
Well, not literally.
No. My wife Penny pinches her nose all the time, and she is just fine. Her brain is intact, and that's how she handles her sneeze. She often holds in her sneeze. She'll pinch it, and it'll be a little one. Whereas when I have a sneeze, I just want to let her rip.
Yeah, me too. Is the pinching is supposedly, doesn't nothing comes out? So,
well, not as much comes out because you have your nose pinched and then your brains out.
I mean, is that why people do it? So that...
I don't know. I've asked her why she did it, and her mother told her to do that. So I think people do it because it's propagated by parents. I don't know what it is. But in this case, his mother didn't do it, and one day she stooped over the garbage can with blood spurting from her nose. Well, we know that dry noses can produce epistaxis, which is blood coming from the nose. That if you actually push on your nose sometimes, that can also produce, blood coming from the nose. But I don't think it has anything to do with pinching your nose. So if you're a pincher or a non-pincher, it's just fine.
Have a possible myth for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413 is our number. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Billings, Montana. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
I've been diagnosed with anxiety by a psychiatrist years ago. Does that mean I'm mentally ill?
Oh, no, not at all.
Thank you.
Not at all. You are not mentally ill if you have anxiety. That's not the case.
That's what my dictionary said, too.
Yeah, you mean that you weren't mentally ill.
What about agoraphobia? That was also
No. You know, first of all, mental illness is a terrible term when you think about it. I mean, it's a bad term. It's a term like that probably should go in the wastebasket, just like we got rid of the word retarded. Mm. You know, it's a bad term. It has lots of baggage attached to it that we don't want to have attached to it, you know, when I think about it. Agoraphobia is fear of crowds. And it's common. Panic attacks that are often associated with a common. It's not, you know, calling it a form of mental illness just sort of puts a whole different, if you will, covering to it. Tell me about your agoraphobia.
Well, I don't mind being somewhere where there are many people. It's just the going there.
Right.
Driving myself.
Right. That. But if somebody else drives you, you're okay?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you're okay. So it doesn't bother you at all. It's that driving. Is it the driving there, or is it the walking into the room that bothers you?
Oh, it's the town.
It's the town. You mean it's going?
It's the people in the town.
But you don't mind once you're there. What happens once you're around the people?
Oh, I'm fine.
Then you're okay.
Mm-hmm. Rarely leave the house. Uh-huh. I'm even afraid to be in the house.
So let's go for that a second. Have you ever taken anything for that, such as an antidepressant?
I refuse to take any drugs at all.
Okay. Well, let me tell you a little bit just about agoraphobia, fear of crowds, and what you said, what you're describing is similar to it. But before that, let me go back. Have you had a panic attack where all of a sudden you sort of felt like things were out of control and you just couldn't control the situation?
Absolutely. Very frequently.
Okay. Well, it turns out that low-dose antidepressants can do a remarkable job with panic attacks and agoraphobia. And it's because antidepressants work outside of depression. I mean, they're not just for depression. They're marvelous drugs with social anxiety. So I often give it for people with stage fright. If beta blockers don't work, I give it to people intermittently when they're going to go into situations. They say, look, I'm going to be going to a wedding and I'm concerned about this wedding, or I'm running a wedding, and I'll give them a low-dose antidepressant for a few weeks before the wedding. They tend to work better if you take them every day than if you take them intermittently.
So it's something you have to be on permanently for the rest of your life?
No. These just tend to work better. So let's say you have a summer party you're going to go to. It's better to start it a week before if you know it's a big event and it's going to bother you. And what it does is it unlinks the thought from the emotion. So in other words, you may have the thought of, gee, I really don't feel like getting in the car and driving myself to this. But the emotional impact, you sort of have an unlink. That's the best way to describe it. So you don't reflexly go into that uncomfortable situation. Now, what that does in the end is you stop often over time, especially if you take it on a regular basis, if you stop having that emotional attachment to what you're doing. I have a lot of people on it, and they say they feel normal. One of my favorite patients recently passed away. I found a very low-dose antidepressant that worked for her probably 20 years before she passed. She wouldn't go out of her house. I live in a small town, Oregon, Wisconsin. She wouldn't go out of the house, even to shop at Bill's Grocery Store. And once I put her on that, she could go out of the house and go shopping at Bill's at the grocery store. That's what she could do. Now, she never got to the point where she wanted to drive into Madison to do something. She didn't mind if somebody else drove her, but she got to a point where she functioned better, and she liked that, and so she decided to stay on it, you know, and it's a choice. So you don't have to take it forever. But you may want to try it. Give it a 2 to 3 week trial and see whether or not you feel differently. You just may want to try it, either using intermittently or on a daily basis. It's something I think you ought to consider. Don't just throw out the baby with the bathwater. Thank you so much for your call. Really appreciate
it. You're fabulous.
Thank you.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And before we head out, Zorba, let's take an email question from a listener named William in Jacksonville, Florida. He writes, "Dear Zorba, on a recent show, you reported testing by consumer labs showing that their testing of a number of common supplements from a number of popular stores revealed that many did not contain any of the active ingredients. I went to their website but could not find details without becoming a subscriber. I wanted to check them out before subscribing and checked several sources. You seem to consider them to be a reputable website with reliable and useful information, but other websites give them bad reviews, mainly because their business model contains serious conflicts of interest.
Well, first of all, I don't know what their business model is, so I'm not going to state anything about it. I have found them to be a reputable app, good. They're pay-as-you-go. They're not sponsored by anything. So you, in order to get in the site, you have to pay some money to get into the site. And then they do independent testing. So I like them. You may decide to use them. You may decide to go to Consumer Reports, which also is an excellent site for which you have to pay. Because basically this is not free information because it's a pay-as-you-go situation. So I've used them before. That's my opinion. There are other sites that you may decide you want to use. However, the real issue here that I think that is important is for many of these sites, you can either get a yearly subscription, a monthly subscription, a daily subscription, or a weekly subscription. And I think we as consumers have to get used to so many things are free on the web. Mm-hmm. We have to get used to the fact that we have to pay for some things. Like if you want to get the New York Times, you can get 5 visits a month, and after that you've got to pay some money. Well, gee, otherwise how are they going to actually pay for what they're doing?
Yeah.
And I think it's the same thing for like Consumer Lab too. I'm going to do some more research on them, but you also have to look at when there's negative stuff on the web, who sponsored that? Was it sponsored perhaps by the supplement companies that they dished? Or was it actually an independent source that said they don't have a good model? Who said they were bad? Was it the people that Consumer Lab said were bad? Good question, isn't
interesting.
It?
Interesting. Have a question for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, we post on Facebook.
And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7000. 413. Carl never sleeps. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production.
Well, he has a new baby, so you're right. He never sleeps.
The program is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0416Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.